Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and we've got May 7th, and there's a question. You want to talk to me after class?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. All right, so don't forget, our final, I'm just checking the key right here for the final exam schedule, is Tuesday, May 19th at 10:30. So it's a little bit earlier than normal, 10:30 to 12:30, okay, on Tuesday, May 19th. So we have a lecture today, a lecture on Tuesday, and then no class Wednesday, no class Thursday the 14th. It's a week from, it's a week from today is when it is, basically, okay?
We don't have any classes.
So next week we do have a class on Tuesday.
Thursday,
new. No class on Thursday, and then the final on Tuesday. Yeah, hi.
Is the exam 100 questions?
It's going to be the same format. Probably 100 questions. That seems like a good number. It's 2 hours. So just one Scantron will do it. It won't be more than 100 questions. Okay, yeah. So no more than 100 questions. All right, anybody got a question on the final schedule? Well, I got it right here. Yeah. The final exam is going to cover a chapter that covers blood pressure, cardiac output, peripheral resistance, and I believe that is 14, chapter 14. We're skipping immunity. So we're going right to respiratory, which is 16, and then chapter 17, which is urinary system. Okay? So we're going to start that today. So those three chapters. 14, 16, 17. Got it. Okay. All right. So anybody have any questions over respiratory system? Yes. Yes. Osmolality just has to do with solutes that are dissolved in solution. And the solution is water in us. All right, so anything that dissolves in water becomes a solute. And water itself is going to be pulled from an area of low solute concentration to high solute concentration. Because instead of thinking of solutes, think in terms of water concentration. That's the same direction as going from a high water concentration to a low water concentration. All right, so that's how diffusion is going to work, and if it's across a membrane, that's how osmosis is going to work. So is that what you mean? Yeah? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Just
the number of solutes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The higher the solute concentration, the more it's going to pull water in. Okay. Okay. All right, so I think we left off talking about how oxygen is carried in the blood. So there's a couple metabolites that we're very interested in knowing how they're transported in the blood. And one is oxygen. What's the other important gas? Carbon dioxide. Yeah. And the solubility of those two gases are drastically different. Carbon dioxide likes to dissolve in fluid, in water, or plasma very nicely, but oxygen doesn't. Very little amount of oxygen likes to dissolve in blood. And so evolution has figured out another way how to put oxygen into blood so that it can be transported. And that is via a molecule that is called hemoglobin, and that's where we left off last time. Where the heck is it? I haven't been there yet. Wow. Slide 65? Okay, it says 60. Here it is, but I rearranged slides. Okay. All right, so hemoglobin. That's what we're going to talk about right now. Okay, so hemoglobin transports oxygen. And hemoglobin is found in red blood cells, There's almost 300 million hemoglobin molecules in every red blood cell. So it's the red blood cells that transport oxygen because they contain hemoglobin. Loading of hemoglobin with oxygen occurs in the lungs, and unloading occurs in tissues, which is really nice because we want oxygen basically to diffuse from high concentration in the air to low concentration in our tissues so that mitochondria can use that oxygen to make what kind of compound? ATP, for instance. Okay. All right. The affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen changes with a number of physiological variables, and hopefully you'll see that it's fortunate that it does, or it's a good thing that it does, because it helps with delivery of oxygen to tissues. All right, so here is the heme part of hemoglobin, and you can see it's a large organic molecule, and in the very center held within these nitrogen groups right here is an iron. And this iron compound is what binds oxygen, and a hemoglobin molecule is made up of four different protein chains, and each of those chains contains one heme group. So every hemoglobin molecule can attach and carry four oxygen molecules. So that's pretty handy. Okay, so when a red blood cell dies, then your body recycles this compound, right? So the proteinaceous chains, the globin molecules, are broken down into amino acids. The heme is broken down into iron and bilirubin, and then iron can be recycled again, and then your body gets rid of the bilirubin and bile salts. All right, so if we have an oxygen bottle right here, and we just bubble oxygen through two different solutions, water solutions, or maybe we could say plasma without red blood cells, and then measure the concentration of oxygen that dissolves into this plasma solution, we're going to see that the partial pressure of oxygen is 100 millimeters of mercury. So that's very similar to thinking about just the concentration of oxygen in terms of the partial pressure because it's a gas. All right, which turns out to be about 0.3 milliliters of oxygen for every 100 mLs of plasma. Not very much, right? It's less than a percent, right? It's 0.3% basically. Very, very small amount. All right, but now if we put in to this plasma, if we add red blood cells that of course have hemoglobin, right, in them, and every hemoglobin can bind four oxygens, and then don't forget every red blood cell has basically 400 million hemoglobin molecules. What's the increase in carrying capacity of whole blood for oxygen? Well, oxygen is still going to dissolve in the plasma to the same amount, which is 0.3 mLs. So we can see some oxygen dissolved in the plasma, but now all of the hemoglobin is saturated with oxygen as well. And that increases, and when hemoglobin binds oxygen, we call it oxyhemoglobin. All right, so the addition of that oxyhemoglobin, if we were to think of all the oxygen in solution right here, including those that are bound to hemoglobin, the content goes up to 20 mLs per 100 mLs of blood, of whole blood. So you can see now it's what, about 20% of the volume, which is a huge increase, right? So now blood can actually carry a huge amount of oxygen in the blood, even though the partial pressure is the same, right? Because of hemoglobin, right, we can carry a major proportion of the blood volume as oxygen. So that's very, very nice. Okay. Hemoglobin not only binds oxygen, but it can also bind carbon monoxide. And carbon monoxide is sort of like carbon dioxide, except it's missing an oxygen. And carbon monoxide is actually very deadly because when it binds to hemoglobin, it doesn't allow oxygen to bind to it. So the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood decreases. Furthermore, carbon monoxide is really dangerous because the affinity of carbon monoxide for hemoglobin is 200 times stronger than oxygen. So, for instance, if we have a hemoglobin, so I'm just going to diagram that as an Fe, and there's a carbon monoxide bound to it, right? We can actually get oxygen to bind or have an equal shot at binding to this iron molecule right here if we draw in how many oxygen molecules around it. So now you only see one carbon monoxide, but how many oxygen molecules are we going to have to add to the system to have a 50-50 chance of getting rid of this carbon monoxide, to have an equal chance of iron binding to oxygen? 200. I'm going to have to draw 210 of them. So you know what? I think I'm going to stop. So that's the antidote for carbon monoxide poisoning. So carbon monoxide is very deadly, and we put people, if we can find them alive, put them on oxygen, and then that has pure oxygen, and then that can remove the carbon monoxide and hopefully save their life. But so very small concentrations of carbon monoxide are deadly as a result of that. So where does that carbon monoxide come from? Do we have to worry about that right now, where we are? No, not necessarily so. But it comes from the combustion of organic fuels like gasoline and charcoal briquettes and gasoline and things that you use to heat your house up. And that usually happens, I would guess, maybe about to maybe 10 families a year in the United States that die of carbon monoxide because their furnaces don't behave properly in the fall when they turn it on, and they go to bed, fall asleep, and then don't wake up because carbon monoxide is odorless and you can't see it, and there are really no symptoms for carbon monoxide poisoning other than maybe a headache. And if you're asleep, you don't feel that headache. So small concentrations are extremely deadly because of the affinity for hemoglobin. Okay. So you got oxyhemoglobin and carboxyhemoglobin. Those are a couple forms that you should be aware of. Okay, so here is a table that shows the percent or the partial pressures, which is basically, again, think of partial pressure as the concentration of oxygen in different two different parts of your body. Arterial blood has a partial pressure of 100 millimeters of mercury. Venous blood has a partial pressure of 40 millimeters of mercury. All right, so where did that oxygen go? It left the blood, right, and went into tissues and is being utilized by cells, right, for oxidative phosphorylation, for instance, in mitochondria. All right, but then if we look at the percent oxyhemoglobin in blood when it's at 100 millimeters of mercury pressure, partial pressure versus 40, okay, we can see that the percent changes from 97%, almost 100% bound, okay, to just 75%. And then if we make some intermediate measurements all the way down to about 20% over here and measure the concentration or the partial pressure or the percent oxyhemoglobin, all right, these are the numbers that we come up with. And when we look at those numbers, I don't think it means a whole lot to us. So if you have a bunch of numbers, what's a nice way to display a bunch of data as numbers, something that you can just look at to get a feel for what's going on? Make a graph out of it, right? All right, so let's make a graph of percent oxyhemoglobin versus partial pressure, which is the concentration in a fluid, and here it is. So here's the percent oxyhemoglobin saturation of red blood cells versus partial pressure. So this is what we call a hemoglobin binding curve. And you can see as the partial pressure increases, what happens to the percent oxyhemoglobin saturation? It increases. So it's directly related to each other, right? So as the partial pressure of oxygen increases, so does the amount of oxygen bound to hemoglobin. But it's not a nice straight line. It's kind of this funny S-shaped curve. We call that a sigmoidal curve, right? And then this other axis over here, we just convert from percent oxyhemoglobin saturation to milliliters of oxygen per 100 milliliters of blood. This is another nice way of thinking about percent oxyhemoglobin saturation. And so down over here, we have the physiologic range of partial pressure of oxygen. In arteries, we said it is 100, right? And then in tissues, this oxygen is used. And at the venous end of a capillary, it's 40 millimeters of mercury. So this is the change in pressure as hemoglobin gives up oxygen to the tissues. And what does that amount to? That amounts to about what, 5 milliliters of oxygen per 100 milliliters of blood. That's what unbinds from hemoglobin. All right, and as the tissues take up oxygen, all right, then more hemoglobin likes to release oxygen. So you could kind of think of this as like being Le Chatelier's principle, right, or the law of mass action. If we take oxygen out of the system, then some oxygen is going to be released from hemoglobin, right, just be due to the law of mass action. All right, so from the change from here to here is the amount of oxygen that's delivered to the tissues. All right, so hemoglobin does give up oxygen to tissues. Okay, so what else could affect the release of oxygen to tissues? Let's think about pH, because pH might change a little bit. All right, so here is a table that shows a couple different pHs. Normal blood pH is very close to 7.4. Might be more like 7.35, but 7.4 is pretty good. And so we see the affinity is normal at that normal pH, so we'll just define that as having normal affinity. All right, the arterial oxygen content is about 20, and if we change the pH, the arterial oxygen content is still basically about 20 mLs per 100 mLs of blood. That doesn't change very much. Okay, but as the pH changes, look at the venous content of oxygen. And you can see as the pH decreases from or increases, the oxygen content of venous blood goes up, which means what? That means that not as much oxygen is being delivered to the tissues if it's still in the blood, but as the pH becomes more acidic, the venous O2 content actually goes less than normal, which means more oxygen is being delivered to the tissues as the tissues become more acidic. All right, so here is the actual number of oxygen unloaded to the tissues per 100 mLs of blood. Now, is that a good thing? Does that kind of make sense? When does a tissue need more oxygen compared to when it's at rest? Let's say it's a muscle. When a muscle is exercising, for instance, it needs more oxygen to make more ATP. And when a muscle is exercising, okay, it does increase the acidity in its local environment because when a muscle's contracted, there's no blood flow, so it produces a little lactic acid and other metabolites. So the pH of muscles actually does decrease or become acidic with exercise. And what about oxygen delivery? Does it increase or decrease? It goes from 5 to 6.6. Oxygen delivery actually increases. So that's actually a very nice thing. So if we were to plot out oxygen binding or percent saturation with different pHs versus different partial pressures of oxygen right here, all right, we still get that sigmoidal shaped curve, but we can see it's shifting to the right or shifting to the left depending on the pH. All right, so what are the numbers that we're really interested in terms of partial pressures of oxygen? 100, because that's what it is in arterial blood, and 40, because that's what it is in venous blood, basically. All right, so what is the amount of oxygen that's delivered at pH 7.4? Okay, we saw that on a previous slide, so here is about 100 right here, and then it drops down to... Okay, then it drops down to right here for 40. All right, so this is the amount of oxygen that's delivered at pH 7.4, which is a normal pH. But what about at 7.2, for instance, during an exercising muscle? So again, here's a partial pressure of 100. That's still basically completely saturated, almost 100%. Now, what about at 40? Look at that. The percent saturation at 40 millimeters of mercury now is only at 60%. So that means that a lot more oxygen now has been unloaded from hemoglobin and delivered to the tissues. All right, so can you see how to read these curves? All right, so these curves can shift to the right or to the left, but in every case, if it shifts to the right, that shows what? Increased oxygen delivery to tissues. That's really the take-home message. And if you want to show that to yourself or prove that to yourself, then, you know, trace out these two different values of percent oxygen saturation at these two different partial pressures to prove that to yourself. All right? But anytime the curve shifts to the right from this normal pH curve, there is additional delivery of oxygen to tissues as a result. That's what we call a right shift. Okay, so what are some other things that might vary oxygen binding to hemoglobin? There is an important molecule. We're going to talk about temperature as well. It's always good to view temperature. But there's another important metabolite, and that is 2,3-diphosphoglycerate. That's a metabolite in glycolysis. All right? And when there's low partial pressure, for instance, maybe if somebody's at a high altitude, okay, where there is less oxygen in the atmosphere, this leads to less binding of oxygen in a red blood cell, which then leads to less delivery of oxygen to the tissues. All right, but when the red blood cell has lower oxygen, there's less oxyhemoglobin, and oxyhemoglobin inhibits the production of 2,3-DPG. All right, so when somebody's living at altitude, this inhibition goes away, so a person produces more 2,3-DPG in their red blood cells. Right, and that lowers the affinity for hemoglobin of oxygen. That lowers the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen, or vice versa. All right, and so which way does that shift the curve? To the right or to the left? That shifts it to the right. Okay, and what did we say about a right shift? What does that do? That delivers more O2 to the tissues as a result of that. All right, so since you have lower affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin, that increases O2 unloading in the tissues, which then subtracts from this initial stimulus right here of less oxygen delivery. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, and as a matter of fact, this also happens, for instance, in people that are aerobic exercisers. Right, so if somebody exercises like a long distance runner, for instance, and oxygen concentration goes down in their blood, you might think that one of the ways that their body might respond is by producing more and more red blood cells to carry oxygen as your body is using more and more. But what happens to blood flow if you increase the hematocrit? Okay, it decreases. And why does cardiac output decrease as hematocrit increases? For what reason? Okay, because, yeah, you're thinking of Poiseuille's equation, and one term there is viscosity, right? And as you increase the number of cells in blood, the viscosity increases, which increases resistance, which then decreases flow. So it's the hematocrit might increase a little bit, but not dramatically. This is the mechanism that can dramatically increase oxygen delivery to tissues under those circumstances of living at high altitude or during exercise, okay? Because 2,3-DPG increase inside of a red blood cell doesn't change any hemodynamic parameter, doesn't change viscosity of the blood or anything like that. It just increases oxygen delivery. Okay, so I don't have any other curves to show you, but they're instructive to look at. All right, so, but we have a table right here. So instead of showing you oxygen saturation curves, let's just talk about some of these things. So we said that a decrease in pH, which is what? An increase in acidity causes a decrease in affinity, which shifts the curve to the right, right? And that increases oxygen delivery, right, to tissues, right? And during hypercapnia, that's when CO2 is going up and the pH decreases, for instance. All right, as 2,3-DPG increases, that causes a right shift in the oxygen hemoglobin binding curve. And what does that do? That increases oxygen delivery to tissues as well. Okay. Now, what else happens to a muscle when you exercise it besides changing the pH because of production of CO2 and maybe lactic acid? But when you start exercising, what else happens to you? What's the last parameter that we're going to look at here? Right smack in the middle. It is? Temperature. Yeah, what happens when you start exercising? What happens to your temperature? Yeah, it goes up, right? Unless, does anybody in here not sweat when you start exercising? Probably not, right? So you know that your body temperature goes up even though maybe you've never measured it during exercise, but you start sweating, of course you know why, to decrease your body temperature. So when there's an increase in temperature, that also affects the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin. It decreases it, and that shifts the oxygen binding curve to the right, which does what to oxygen delivery? Okay, yeah, it increases oxygen delivery to the tissue. So all these things work in the way that's very beneficial for us, okay, basically with a right shift of that binding curve. Okay. All right, so hemoglobin is very important. There are a number of different kinds of pathological conditions that produce abnormal hemoglobins, and one is called sickle cell disease. And sickle cell disease is a result of a mutation of one just simple base pair in a hemoglobin coding sequence, and that drastically changes the shape of hemoglobin when oxygen partial pressure is low. So we see over here on the left what normal red blood cells look like. Ted, you see them, or I don't see them? It's just too dark where I'm seeing them. I don't know if you can see them. Maybe I don't see them because they're red. But anyway, so they should look round and smooth, right, and continuous, kind of look like discs, maybe with a little dimple in the very center of them, and that they have that shape so that they can lie flat on top of each other and flow through very small blood vessels like capillaries, right? So that way they don't plug up capillaries and blood can flow through these very small vessels. When somebody has sickle cell disease, the hemoglobin takes on a different shape, and that distorts the shape of a red blood cell. So some you can almost look maybe round, but they're oblong. Others have little points on them. Some are kind of spicule shaped, and so people said, yeah, they look like they're sickled. And this kind of shape is such that it has a tendency to plug up very small blood vessels. They don't like to layer on top of each other and provide for nice laminar flow. So these kinds of cells plug up blood vessels. All right, so I'm sure you sort of experienced what this condition is like. Have you ever had a cramp in a muscle? When a muscle just cramps up, and we've talked about this before, okay? All right, so when a muscle cramps up, blood can't get to it, how does that feel? Hurts like hell, right? Okay. Well, somebody that's in sickle cell crisis, that's how they feel all over their body because blood can't get to all their tissues, right? And, of course, their heart still has to beat and their brain still has to function. You don't have pain receptors in your brain, but in all other parts of your body you do. And so that's a really unfortunate inherited condition. And so really the only thing we can do for a couple of things we can do, but not much because we can't genetically cure these individuals yet, is to transfuse them with normal red blood cells, right, to give them fluids, to maintain their hemodynamics, and then also give them something for pain. So what do they need for pain? It's severe pain. What do you have to give for severe pain? Opiates, basically, okay? So this is kind of an unfortunate circumstance, but related to hemoglobin. And when these cells sickle like this, they don't carry oxygen very well. They plug up blood vessels. And they also, the spleen then gets rid of them because they're not helpful to the individual. So sometimes people with sickle cell anemia have an iron overload in their tissues as well because of all the iron that's left over from the hemoglobin. Okay, so that's the importance of hemoglobin. But I think from the scientific or academic interest is that it's just a single point mutation, just one mutation in one base pair can change and produce such a pathology. Okay. All right, so that's oxygen transport in the blood. What about carbon dioxide? We haven't talked about carbon dioxide yet. Carbon dioxide is different from oxygen in that it has a high solubility in fluids. All right, there's a major percent that can dissolve in water, and 10% can just dissolve in plasma. And remember, it was how much for oxygen? It was 0.3%, right? So this is much, much higher. And what's making this CO2? Basically tissues, and then it dissolves into the plasma. And when it's in plasma, of course, it gets carried to the lungs, and then it diffuses out of plasma into the lungs, and you breathe it out of your body. All right, the remainder, 90%, is going to be carried in two different ways. So when CO2 enters the plasma, some of it will diffuse into a red blood cell, and some can combine with hemoglobin to form carbaminohemoglobin. All right, so 20% is carried by hemoglobin. But oxygen is basically what? 100% carried by hemoglobin. Okay. The other CO2 that enters a red blood cell can combine with water and form, what is this right here? And then you should know what the name of that enzyme is. What is this? H2CO3. What is that? That is carbonic acid. And this acid will then dissociate into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ion. All right, and this bicarbonate then will diffuse out of the cell into the plasma and dissolve almost 100% in plasma. So here is carbonic acid, okay, is an acid, and when it dissociates into a hydrogen ion, of course, and the other part is what we call the salt of that acid. So if you have salt at home in your salt shaker and you have a cup of water, how much salt can you put in that cup of water until no more will dissolve? Okay, can you pour like that whole salt shaker in water and have it dissolve? Or is it all going to just fall to the bottom of the cup and not dissolve in water? You know, maybe you should try that, but, you know, almost the whole salt shaker will dissolve in water. Salt just loves to dissolve in water because it's what? It's a polar compound because it's an ion and water is a polar solvent. So we can put almost as much bicarbonate in water as we can imagine, right? So carbon dioxide is transported in the blood as bicarbonate ion, right? And it's 70% because 10% is carbon dioxide is dissolved in the plasma by itself and 20% is bound to hemoglobin. All right, so that's a very efficient way to transport carbon dioxide as the bicarbonate ion. But since bicarbonate is, what kind of ion is bicarbonate? What kind of ion is bicarbonate? It is? What kind of ion? Can you see that little sign right there? What does that mean? It's a negative sign, so that means what kind of ion is that? It's an anion. As a matter of fact, it's what, a monovalent anion? So in order to preserve the electrical neutrality of this red blood cell, as this monovalent anion leaves, there has to be another monovalent anion that enters, and that is chloride. All right, so we call this the chloride shift. When bicarbonate goes out, chloride goes in, and if bicarbonate goes into the cell, what comes out to maintain electrical neutrality? That's going to be a chloride ion again. All right, so that shifts with bicarbonate right here. All right, so now you have this blood flowing into the lung. So here we are in the lung. So instead of tissues, we have this alveolar space right here, which is really low in CO2. And so CO2 is going to diffuse from plasma into this alveolus right here, down its concentration gradient. And as the plasma concentration decreases, then, again, think of Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action, then carbamamino hemoglobin is going to dissociate because this carbon dioxide is going to go into the plasma to replace the ones that have diffused out, right? And then again, that's going to diffuse into the alveolus, and that's going to unload a lot of the carbamamino hemoglobin as a result. Okay, so carbon dioxide is lost from this red blood cell. But what else is going to happen? Well, again, because of Le Chatelier's principle, if this CO2 is leaving the cell, what's going to happen to this equation? It's going to be driven in the reverse direction, right? And did I ask you what was the name of that enzyme? I forgot. What's the name of that enzyme that allows this reaction to take place very quickly? Carbonic anhydrase, right? So now bicarbonate enters the cell, chloride comes out, and bicarbonate combines with this hydrogen to form carbonic acid, and then carbonic acid dissociates into carbon dioxide, and then carbon dioxide moves down its concentration gradient right into the alveolus, and you exhale it out of your body. All right. So this is just the reverse reaction that takes place in the tissue spaces. All right. So this, of course, is a capillary because you have a nice simple squamous endothelium right here. Okay, so under normal breathing, we see that we get almost 100% saturation of hemoglobin with oxygen. So if we were to hyperventilate, could we increase the saturation of hemoglobin? If it's 100% when you're breathing quietly, right, and you're not exercising, and if you hyperventilate right now, you're still going to have the same amount of oxygen bound to hemoglobin because it's basically 100%. You can't do any better than that. But when somebody hyperventilates, okay, then we can lose a lot of CO2 from our blood, right? The more you hyperventilate, the more CO2 you're going to lose. And when you lose CO2, what happens to this equation right here? It gets shifted. Let's just say this is to the left. It gets shifted to the left. And what are you using up inside your body when this carbonic anhydrase reaction shifts to the left? You're using up hydrogen ions, right, to combine with bicarbonate. And so when people hyperventilate, that produces a respiratory alkalosis. What is alkalosis? When you become more acidic or more basic? You become more basic, right? That's a respiratory alkalosis. Okay, and as a matter of fact, if somebody has an acidosis, maybe a metabolic acidosis, some abnormality in their body that is producing hydrogen ions, what is one way that your body compensates for an excessive production of acid? Is by hyperventilation. All right, so just by increasing ventilation, you can lose CO2, and as you lose CO2, what is your body being depleted of? Hydrogen ions. Right, so that's pretty interesting. So you could think of carbon dioxide really as an acid because it produces an acid in your body. So we're actually, what, exhaling a lot of acids in our ventilation. Right, we're excreting acid when we breathe out. Not quite so much like alien, but pretty close. All right, so that's it for respiratory system. Anybody have any questions about that? Okay. Okay, so now our last chapter, urinary system. Okay, so all these PowerPoints are in Blackboard. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about the structure as well as the function of the kidney, and then talk about some of the smaller pieces of a kidney and some processes like filtration and reabsorption, plasma clearance and control of electrolytes a little bit, and some acid-base control via the kidneys. I'm not going to talk too much about the structure of the kidney because you should pretty much know that already. All right, but we'll review some of the functions. So if you don't remember the kidney, go ahead and break out your anatomy books and make sure you know everything about the kidney that you had to know in anatomy, like all the blood vessels that go around inside the kidney and the different parts of the kidney and the internal parts and external parts. Okay, so let's talk about some of the functions of the kidney. Well, of course, it's easy to understand how it helps regulate plasma and interstitial fluid by the formation of urine. So if your kidney is forming a lot of urine, it gets fluid from inside your body and it's excreted. And that comes from interstitial spaces, or it could come from plasma. All right. And as a result of that, since the kidney is getting fluid from plasma, that's going to control blood volume. The kidney can control blood volume. And when blood volume goes up or down, that contributes to blood pressure in a number of different ways, right? So that can influence venous return, which is going to influence end-diastolic volume, or what we call the preload of the heart, and that's going to increase force of contraction, increase cardiac output, and then increase blood pressure. So the kidney has an important role in maintaining blood pressure. Oh, and what's the most important mechanism that you should know that involves the kidney for the long-term regulation of blood pressure? What is that called? It's a really long title. It's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, okay? All right, well, also in the formation of urine, your body gets rid of waste products that are in plasma, and it also helps regulate the concentration of certain electrolytes like sodium, potassium, bicarbonate, and chloride ions, for instance, as well. And another ion that it helps regulate the concentration of is the hydrogen ion, or protons, and that's a measurement of pH, right? That's what determines what pH is. So it regulates acid-base balance in our body. All right, and then there's something that's not on the slide that you should probably have on your slide. It was what we covered on the last test. And what's another function of the kidney that we don't have right here? I see some hemodynamic things. I see some chemical properties that the kidneys help regulate. But what else do the kidneys help regulate? The red blood cell production, right? Red blood cell production. And how does the kidney help regulate red blood cell production? Because it secretes a hormone. What's the name of that hormone? It's erythropoietin. Does that ring a bell? Erythropoietin. Okay, write that down on this slide. All right, so that's another really important function of the kidney, because red blood cell production should be stimulated, because how many red blood cells do you have to make in your body every second, for instance? A lot. This is true. It's a big number. Even by today's standards, it's a big number. About 2.5 million every second, all right? So, and if you don't make that much every second, then of course you'll become anemic. All right, let's just look quickly at the gross structure of the urinary system. Well, urine is produced by the kidneys, and remember, they're behind the peritoneal membrane, so we call them retroperitoneal. There's usually a lot of nice fat around them that prevent, that insulate them from shock and trauma. And so they're up against the posterior abdominal wall. And the way urine gets from the kidney to the urinary bladder right here is via the ureters. And then urine is, so the kidneys produce urine all the time, and it's stored in the urinary bladder until there's a proper time to void. And then we void urine by letting urine pass through the urethra right here to the outside world. All right, so that's the urinary system. The kidneys are about as big as a fist. You got two of them bilaterally. And then if we look on the inside of a kidney, we can see that it has a superficial layer and then a deep layer. The superficial layer is what we call the cortex. The deep layers we call the medulla. And in the medulla, we have these triangular-shaped structures called pyramids. And in between the pyramids, we have the renal columns. And basically, in the renal columns, we have the arteries that supply the cortex, like the interlobar arteries, right, are between the pyramids. And the pyramids contain a lot of tubes, like collecting ducts and the loop of Henle, that are all oriented facing the tip of this renal pyramid. And so urine comes out of a pyramid at the tip right here and drains into this collecting basin. Right, so just a nice connective tissue sheath that collects urine. And this basin right here at the tip of a pyramid is called a calyx. And actually it's called a minor calyx. All right, so here's a minor calyx, here's a minor calyx. And where two minor calyces come together, like right here, then that's what we call a major calyx. All right, so here is another tip of a renal pyramid. So you're looking down into a minor calyx that is going to then empty urine out into this region. And then it flows into the renal pelvis, which is this funnel-shaped structure, down through the ureter into the urinary bladder. Okay, so let's look at a pyramid. Here's a pyramid. Here are some tubules inside of a kidney. And these little things right here are what we call renal corpuscles. Inside is a capillary, a very leaky capillary. And that fluid that leaks out then makes its way through the tubular system and then finally becomes urine. So this fluid inside these tubes is not really urine until it gets to this point right here, which is what we call the collecting duct. All right, so this is what helps make up the tubular system of the kidney. We have the Bowman's capsule, otherwise known as the glomerular capsule. And this first twisty and curvy tube right here is called a proximal convoluted tubule because it's attached to Bowman's capsule. And why do we say that's a convoluted tubule? Why is that a convoluted tubule? Because, yeah, what does convoluted mean? Yeah, it has a lot of twists and turns in it, right? So somebody could try to convince you of something by using a very convoluted argument, which is what? A kind of argument. It's hard to follow, right? It's hard to understand, okay? Because there's a lot of twists and turns in it. And then we've got the loop of Henle, and you can see the loop of, well, I'll get to that in a second. And then a second convoluted tubule we call the distal convoluted tubule because it's far away from Bowman's capsule. And then the fluid enters the collecting duct, and then once it's in the collecting duct, we really consider it urine. The material that enters Bowman's capsule right here is what we call filtrate, and then it's processed by three processes before it becomes urine. So we're going to look at those three processes. All right, so we can see the renal cortex. All right, so the glomerular capsules are in the cortex, and parts of the convoluted tubules are in the cortex, and the loops of Henle are down in the medulla that make up the pyramid. So here is a nice X-ray with contrast that shows, here's a nice minor calyx, major calyx when they form together, and then the renal pelvis, and we see a nice ureter down to urinary bladder right here. Okay, so how do we void? We use the micturition reflex to void. The bladder has smooth muscle, and it's called the detrusor muscle. When the bladder stretches, that causes spontaneous action potentials in this smooth muscle right here. So this smooth muscle is not autorhythmic, but it has a plexus that becomes stimulated when it is stretched. Okay, the innervation is controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system. So the parasympathetic nervous system is what? Stimulatory for urination or voiding. Urinary bladders that are overactive use muscarinic acetylcholine antagonists to reduce that spasm. All right, so action, there are two sphincters, right? And a sphincter is a circular muscle. Usually we think of a sphincter as a circular smooth muscle, but in the urinary system and digestive system, there's a sphincter that's made out of skeletal muscle, so it is under voluntary control. All right, so but both the internal and external urethral sphincters are regulated by a reflex center that's located in the sacral part of the spinal cord. And it is the external urethral sphincter that is under voluntary control. The internal is under autonomic control, which is controlled by the reflex center. So filling the bladder activates stretch receptors that send impulses to the spinal cord, the micturition reflex center. This activates the parasympathetic neurons, causing contraction of the detrusor muscle. And that also relaxes the internal urethral sphincter. All right, so this is the one that's under autonomic control. All right, and that puts pressure on the urethra, and that gives you a sense of urgency or voiding. All right, and then you have voluntary control over the external urethral sphincter, because that's skeletal muscle. And so then urination is consciously initiated via descending motor tracts that inhibit, right, the micturition center. And then the external urethral sphincter relaxes and urine is expelled. Okay, so you have these two sphincters for urination. One is under autonomic control and one is under somatic control. All right, so now let's stop thinking about some gross structures of the kidney, but let's think about some microscopic structures of the kidney. And in this class, we talked about the structural and functional unit of life. What's that? That's a cell. Structural and functional unit of contraction. What's that? Contraction. Spring break. No, that's not it. It is? What? Sarcomere, right? Sarcomere. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? I'm hearing a lot of good stuff. I'm hearing like acetylcholine. That's a neurotransmitter. It's a part of the system. It's a synapse. Yeah, synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, right? And most synapses are chemical. There's a few that are electrical. And the nice thing about knowing a structural and functional unit is once you understand that structural and functional unit, you can apply it to everything in your body, right? So here's a good question. What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? You should know the name, and then we're going to study how how to understand what that name is. And the name is what? What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? It is the nephron. It's the nephron. Okay, if somebody said that and I didn't hear you, it's just the way it goes. Okay, it's the nephron. So we're going to talk about the nephron right now. We have about 1 million nephrons per kidney, so these are microscopic. You can't see them. Maybe you don't need an electron microscope to see them, but you do need a microscope. It consists of many small tubes. All right, so here we see these tubes, and I've talked about the tubes before. So these are the tubular elements of the nephron, but it also has blood vessels working with these tubes right here, and I call those the vascular elements. So a nephron basically has two kinds of elements, tubular elements and vascular elements, and they work together to perform these three processes right here. The first one is glomerular filtration. Put a little R in there. Glomerular filtration. The second process is tubular reabsorption. The third process is tubular secretion. And we're going to look and see where these different processes are. And as a result of these three processes, then we are producing urine and doing all those regulatory functions that we talked about, like excreting excess hydrogen ions or salt and maintaining blood pressure and getting rid of toxic materials like urea. Okay? So the nephron is the right answer. You can see that the glomerular capsule and proximal convoluted tubule is in the cortex. The loops of Henle and collecting ducts and a portion of the distal convoluted tubule is in the medulla of the kidney. So here's the line of demarcation between medulla and cortex. And of course, the pyramids are in the medulla of the kidney. Okay. So make sure you know the blood supply to the kidney. So how does blood get into a kidney? How does blood get into a kidney? Via? It's an artery. I'll give you a hint. It's an artery. Okay? How about renal artery? Okay, renal artery. And then once that blood is in the kidney, what happens to the renal artery? It bifurcates. What does it make? It bifurcates into the segmental arteries, right? And then the segmental arteries bifurcate into the interlobar arteries that go through the columns, and then at the top of the, I guess maybe I'll go back to this slide right here. All right, so renal artery, and then it bifurcates to segmental and then interlobar, and when it gets into the cortex, then it bifurcates into these that form little arches over the base of these pyramids right here. Those are what we call the arcuate arteries, right? This is all should be ringing a bell for you. And then branching off of the arcuate arteries are the cortical radiate arteries. Sometimes they're called the interlobular arteries, but probably cortical radiate is better. Okay, and then some branches off the cortical radiate are what we call the afferent arterioles. All right, and the afferent arterioles supply the glomeruli, which are special leaky capillaries inside Bowman's capsule. All right, so the glomeruli are masses of capillaries inside the glomerular capsule or Bowman's capsule that gives rise to filtrate that enters the nephron. All right, and whatever doesn't filter out into Bowman's capsule leaves via the efferent arteriole. All right, so the efferent arteriole drains the glomerulus and delivers blood to the peritubular capillaries. And in certain parts of the nephron, we also call that the vasorecta. Right, and then blood from the peritubular capillaries enter the renal venules, very, very small veins, and then they enter the cortical radiate veins. And the nice thing about knowing the blood vessels of the kidney is if you know the correct sequence of arteries, then all you have to do is change the name artery to vein, and you know the correct sequence of blood vessels that leave. There's no change in name. Okay. So what's the name of the big vein leaving the kidney? If the big artery that is entering is the renal artery, then what's leaving is the renal vein. Okay. I was just checking to see if anybody is awake. Okay. Okay, so think of the nephron as being made up of tubular elements. Here's a list of the tubular elements. These do not contain blood. These contain either filtrate or urine. All right, so the first part is Bowman's capsule, otherwise known as the glomerular capsule. Attached to that is the PCT. Then you got the descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle. All right, and then after that, the DCT, and then that empties into the collecting duct. So these right here contain filtrate, and when filtrate enters the collecting duct, we consider that urine, although it can still be processed a little bit in the collecting duct. Okay? All right, so there's a lot of processing of filtrate in these divisions right here. All right, so here are the vascular elements that are used to make up a nephron. Entering the Bowman's capsule is the afferent arteriole. Here is a capillary that we call the glomerulus. And this is a special kind of capillary inside the renal corpuscle because it's fenestrated. So what does that mean if we say it's a fenestrated capillary compared to what other kinds of capillaries are there? You know some other? Yeah, somebody said continuous. I like that. So fenestrated is a lot different than a continuous capillary because the fenestrated has little holes or windows in it, so it's very leaky. It's a leaky kind of capillary. The holes are not big enough for cells to leave, like red blood cells or white blood cells or thrombocytes, all right? But they're big enough to allow relatively large molecules. Even some small proteins can leak out of the blood and go into Bowman's capsule. Other molecules, like glucose, are really small. They get filtered out into the filtrate very easily as well. So glucose is lost from the blood in the first stages of urine production. And what can you tell me about glucose? Is that a good molecule to lose, or is that a bad molecule to lose? It's bad, because what do we do with glucose? We make ATP out of it, and that's what keeps us alive. So we don't want to lose glucose in urine, but we just said that in this first step over here, we lose a lot of it. So we're going to have to see how we get it back. Okay, then the part of the blood that doesn't leave the glomerulus enters the efferent arteriole, and the efferent arteriole then feeds another capillary bed we call the peritubular capillaries. And so maybe you should have a picture in your mind where these are. Peri means what? Surrounding, right? Surrounding the tubes of the nephron, like the distal convoluted tubule and loops of Henle. All right, so what does a usual circulation have in terms of number of capillary beds between an artery and a vein? So the heart pumps out blood into an artery, and of course it's going to go to a capillary. And then in most of the circulation, after that capillary, where does the blood go? It usually goes back to the heart. How does it get back to the heart? With a vein, right? So in the usual kind of circulation, you've got an artery, a capillary, and a vein, and you're done. But here's a different kind of system. What do we have? We have an artery, we got a capillary, but we also have what? A second capillary bed that's interconnected with this efferent arteriole. Before it enters a vein, it goes back to the heart. So what kind of circulatory system do we call this? Because it's not the usual kind. What is this thing called? And could you give me an example in another part of your body where you have two capillary beds back to back? Do you agree that that's special, or doesn't that not seem really special? It should be special. Okay, that's called a portal circulation, right? A portal circulation. Maybe you remember the hepatic portal circulation where there are capillary beds in your gastrointestinal tract, right? They absorb things from our digestive tract, and then they coalesce into a vein, but that vein doesn't go back to the heart, right? Because it has to be detoxified by the liver first. So it takes all that blood to the liver for detoxification, and then it's put in another vein, and then it goes back to the heart. So there are two capillary beds, and that's called the what? The hepatic portal system, right? So here is another example of a portal system in the renal system of a kidney. Okay, so here is a really good picture that shows all this stuff. Okay, so let's, again, maybe just review a little bit of anatomy. So here are the interlobar arteries that are in the renal columns between the pyramids, right? These are feeding the arcuate arteries, and then branching off the arcuate are the cortical radiate arteries. Sometimes we call these the interlobular arteries. And then off of these is the afferent arteriole, which is going to directly take blood to this first leaky capillary inside Bowman's capsule. And that's, what do we call this thing right here? Everybody's got to take a stab at this. It's called what? What is this? Take a breath. It's called the glomerulus, right? Glomerulus. Glomerulus. That might help you with spelling one of these days. Glomerulus. Say it out loud. Okay? And don't forget, fenestrated capillary, a lot of fluid moves out, and what doesn't leave enters the efferent arteriole, right? So here's a portal vessel that feeds a second capillary bed, and these are what we call the peritubular capillaries because they're surrounding all the tubes that make up the nephron, right? And then after surrounding the tubes, it coalesces into the renal venule, which empties into the cortical radiant vein, and then on down the line back to the inferior vena cava. Okay, so here's proximal convoluted tubule, descending loop, ascending loop, and distal convoluted tubule. All right, so make sure you know this diagram right here. Okay, so I've talked about all this already. Okay. On this particular slide, what do we want to see on this particular slide? Well, you know, there are two different kinds of nephrons in the kidney. Here is one. So this is a renal corpuscle because it has a glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule. So here you can see it in an expanded form, the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule that makes a renal corpuscle. This is where plasma is leaking out into Bowman's capsule, and it's going to make its way through the tubular system. So this first step of plasma being filtered out because of a pressure gradient, it's not just diffusion, but it's pressure. So there is pressure inside these capillaries, and there's very low pressure inside Bowman's capsule, so that's actually forcing fluid out. These are all located in the cortex. But then you see some other nephrons where this cortical nephron, the proximal and distal convoluted tubule is in the cortex, and only a very little bit of the loop of Henle is down in the medulla of the kidney. So we call this a cortical nephron. This one over here, where the loop of Henle deviates very deeply into the medulla, this is what we call a juxtamedullary nephron. And so these two nephrons have a little bit different shape to them, which means what? They're in a little bit different location. So they have a little bit different function. And the function is that the juxtamedullary nephron right here is able to make very concentrated urine, but these cortical nephrons can only make urine that is isotonic to your body. But there might be times when you want to excrete a lot of salt, all right? So you need to make very concentrated urine, so these juxtamedullary nephrons will be doing a lot of the work. All right, so when was the time that you needed to excrete a lot of salt? How about yesterday? After Cinco de Mayo, for instance, maybe, okay? So these are the nephrons that were working. Oh, it says right here, juxtamedullary nephron. Yeah, indeed it is. I was looking for that. I thought they were labeled over here. Okay. So those are the two kinds of nephrons. The proximal convoluted tubule consists of a single layer of cuboidal cells with millions of microvilli on them. What's the function of microvilli? Okay, microvilli. Where did we see that before? I don't know if we actually looked at them before here. Okay. Yeah, you can stretch them out. So they're there because it increases the surface area of the apical surface of the cell. It makes the surface very, very long. So that increases the doorway for absorption. So it enhances absorption. All right, so that increases the surface area for absorption. They're not cilia, it's not for motility, but they're just structure for absorption. All right, so during, and we call this reabsorption. During reabsorption, salt, water, and other molecules needed by the body are transported from the lumen of the tubule, like the proximal convoluted tubule, back into the peritubular capillaries. So this is what we call tubular reabsorption. Okay. Oh, and I talked about this already, the two kinds of nephrons. Okay. All right, so I'm going to draw a nephron really quick on the board. So away goes hemoglobin. So what do we got? Let's see. Can you see that? Oh, that's nice. All right, so tell me what I'm drawing right now. Yeah, glomerulus. And now what? Okay, so I drew like one part of a nephron. What did I draw? The tubular elements of a nephron. All right, so this element right here is what we call what? Bowman's capsule, proximal convoluted tubule, descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule, and then collecting duct. And this, we have urine in here. Okay. All right, and now we also want to draw this stuff. Okay, so here is something going in. What is this structure? Afferent arteriole. And then we got this leaky thing in there. That is the? That's glomerulus right in there. And then this is the efferent arteriole. And this is going to form a second capillary bed. Okay, so these are the peritubular capillaries. All right, so that's basically the nephron right there. And now, let's think of those three processes. What were the three processes? Number one was glomerular filtration. Okay, and is that active or passive? Can anybody remember if filtration is active or passive? It's just passive, just something moving, fluid moving from high pressure to low pressure. It's just passive through some kind of pore in a membrane or a filter paper. All right, the second process is what we're going to call tubular reabsorption. And then the third process is what we're going to call tubular secretion. All right, so where does glomerular filtration take place? That's where there's stuff in glomerulus right here, and it goes into Bowman's capsule through the fenestrations. And we're going to see maybe some other little modifications. All right, so this right here is number one. Okay, another process, tubular reabsorption. All right, so in filtration, 20% of the plasma, okay, leaks out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. So that's a huge number. So what would happen to you if you lost 20% of your blood volume? Okay, well, you just pass out. You dehydrate right away. Okay, and don't forget, glucose is filtered out and other good things. All right, so what has to happen then in the proximal convoluted tubule, those things, those good things that your body needs then are transported back into the peritubular capillaries, right? And so this is tubular reabsorption to recover all that fluid and maybe some electrolytes and glucose that you don't want to lose, right? And then there are other bad things that are in blood that don't get filtered out by the glomerulus, like maybe excessive urea. And so urea ends up in the peritubular capillaries, for instance. All right, and there are mechanisms that can take urea and directly put it into the filtrate, into, say, the distal convoluted tubule. All right, can you? So this is number one. Here is number two. And here is process number three. So can you see that process number two is the opposite direction compared to number three right here? It was just lucky I drew it that way. That's nice, actually. Okay, so which direction do substances move by glomerular filtration? Is it blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood for filtration? Do substances move from blood to filtrate, blood to filtrate, or filtrate to blood? Blood to filtrate. All right, so let's write that down. All right, so blood to filtrate. Which way do substances move for tubular reabsorption? Filtrate to blood. So hence, reabsorption. And then tubular secretion is what? is this first direction. This is blood to filtrate things that you need to remove from your body. Okay, so let's look at some details. Glomerular filtration. We said that they're fenestrated, they have large pores, big enough to allow most any plasma molecule to pass. They're hundreds of times more permeable than continuous capillaries. And so here is an afferent arteriole bringing whole blood in. And let's zoom in to the capillary. So here we see capillaries, but they're covered with part of the surface of Bowman's capsule. So we'll see how that goes in just a second. All right, so we said these are fenestrated capillaries. So here you can see all the fenestrations in the endothelium of the capillary. And then it has to pass over these podocytes right here. They form an outer lining of the glomerulus, but they're leaky as well because they have these filtration slits in them. Right, so these are just processes coming down from the podocytes, and you can see the big filtration slits, so fluid can pass through these things very easily. Now, the reason why these glomerular capillaries are coated with cells is because of Bowman's capsule. Can you remember what a serous membrane is? What's a serous membrane? Like the pleural membrane or the pericardial membrane. What? How many divisions does a serous membrane have? It's got three parts to it, right? Oh, yeah, because we talked about it in terms of respiratory system. The serous membrane that's right on the thoracic wall is called the parietal pleura, right? And then the membrane that's right on the surface of the lungs is called the visceral pleura, and then you got a pleural space in between. Well, the same thing for glomerulus. Use that same model. All right, so here is the outside layer, and think of this as a serous membrane, so this is going to be the parietal layer, and it is continuous with the cells that line and actually touch right on the surface of the glomerular capillary. So these cells are the visceral part of Bowman's capsule. Right? And what do you got in between? You've got a nice vessel or container, right? That is the like the serous cavity that's going to be filled with filtrate when it leaves the glomerulus right here. So you got the parietal division, the visceral division, and in between you've got filtrate that then starts to make its way through the tubular system of the nephron. Okay, so plasma proteins mostly are excluded from the filtrate, even though some maybe could fit through the fenestrations because they are negatively charged. And the filtration slits are lined with negative charges as well. And what can you tell me about like charges? Like electrical charges do what to each other? They repel each other, right? So the podocytes repel these negatively charged proteins. Some proteins, especially albumin, normally enters the filtrate, but most are resorbed right away by receptor-mediated endocytosis. So in the proximal convoluted tubule, those albumins are shipped back right away into the blood, okay, by that special tubular reabsorption process. All right, but if there's a defect in the nephron or in those podocytes or the slit diaphragm that that makes up the Bowman's capsule, that results in massive leakage of protein into the filtrate and thus appears in the urine, all right, so that's that good when that happens, when you have proteinuria, right? There shouldn't be, if it's a healthy nephron, you shouldn't have any or large amounts of protein in the blood or certainly any red blood cells or white blood cells. Now in lab, did you guys test for protein of urine in lab when you did that? That was today, huh? Okay. You're going to do it today. Ah, well, double check. And then let me know if anybody, what the level of protein is in a nice normal population, okay? All right, so here's a nice electron micrograph that shows the visceral division of Bowman's capsule. You can see the podocytes and the foot processes and the filtration slits, right, and the branching pedicels right here. All right, so it's kind of a special cell. Here is a nice electron micrograph that shows the lumen of a capillary, a small basement membrane, and then the slit diaphragm that's formed by the foot processes of the podocytes. And so here is an erythrocyte. So can you see that erythrocyte is way too big to fit through these little pores right here? So here's an fenestration, but molecules like water, glucose, can be filtered very efficiently. Okay, so materials will move from plasma into the filtrate. All right, let me see what else I want to say. Okay, yeah, after I talk about this slide, then that will be it for today. So here is the afferent arteriole bringing in. Now this is challenging for me. We have large molecules, proteins. They're probably colored one way. And then you got smaller molecules, like these solutes right here, going through the fenestrated capillary. And I don't see many of the proteins ending up in filtrate because they're too big, but I see these smaller solute molecules moving through, right? And these solute molecules could be things that are harmful to you or even beneficial to you. They all enter the filtrate and are going to be processed by the kidney. So the way that I envision the nephron working, okay, is how somebody might want to clean their garage. All right, so if you know somebody that has a garage, you might see that they don't park their car in there because there's other stuff in there. It's filled with stuff, okay? And what would be a good way to clean a garage? Open the garage door, reach in and pick something up and look at it and see if that precious thing was something you wanted to throw out or not, and make a decision if you wanted to keep it. If you wanted to keep it, you would do what? Put it right back in the garage. All right, then what would you do with all the other stuff behind it? Well, not much, because you couldn't even get to it. All right, so that's probably a poor way of trying to clean your garage out. A better way would be to open up the garage door and close your eyes and take everything that's in the garage and move it out. Okay, just throw everything out. And then look at all the stuff maybe that's on your lawn and try to make a decision on what you absolutely had to keep, and then put a few items back in your garage. All right. So the kidney does pretty much the same thing. It throws everything out, and then the things that you need for life, it puts back into the blood, right? Which is a more efficient way of trying to decide what to do with material that's in the blood. So good things as well as bad things end up in the filtrate right here. All right, so this process of solutes moving from plasma into the filtrate is called what? Name the process by which these small plasma solutes enter the glomerular filtrate. What's that process called? That's step number one. Step number one, which is what? Glomerular filtration. Blood to filtrate. All right, so then on Tuesday, we're going to finish up this lecture. All right, and then next week, Thursday, no class. And then the week after Tuesday is the last test. Okay? Any questions? All right, and maybe I would like to just say hi for a second before you leave. Okay, yeah. Yeah, but I want to turn my recorders off first.